Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. For two decades now, Americans have discussed, debated, and been divided by the issue of same-sex marriage. The arguments in those two decades haven't changed very much. Supporters of same-sex marriage see it as a civil rights issue and that any limits on the ability of two consenting adults to wed are manifestly unfair. Opponents argue the state has always set some measure of restriction on marriage and fear a slippery slope towards further changes to what they see as traditional marriage. What has changed in recent years is public opinion, which has shifted from majority opposition to majority approval. In this year's election, voters in Maine, Maryland, and Washington endorsed same-sex marriage, the first time such rights have been affirmed directly by voters. Today on the program, we examine the history and politics of same-sex marriage with author, legal expert, and historian Michael Klarman. In his book, From the Closet to the Altar, Klarman examines how the issue has been dealt with by the courts and the political backlash of decisions both for and against same-sex marriage. He also comes to some interesting conclusions about the future of the issue in America and the impact that this long debate has had on the gay rights movement. Michael Klarman teaches constitutional law and constitutional history at Harvard Law School. He once clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. His previous book, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Racial Equality, won a Bancroft Prize from Columbia University in 2005. Michael Klarman, welcome to Focus.
Good morning, Craig. Thanks for having me. I'm
glad to have you with us. And as we discuss the history of court cases, legislation, and political backlash associated with same-sex marriage, we also welcome you to the conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Michael Klarman, to understand the history of the issue of same-sex marriage, I guess we should start by talking a little bit about the history of gay rights in America. And you sort of lay out a brief history of the gay rights movement from the 1950s and 60s up until today in your book. What gave rise to that movement? How did it start?
Well, the modern origins of the movement are often dated to the Stonewall Rebellion in Greenwich Village in 1969. But there were actually groups that were trying to secure better legal and social treatment for gays and lesbians dating back to the early 1950s. I suppose you get a movement for social reform anytime you get a group that identifies its treatment as being unjust. And there were organizations like it was known as the Mattachine Society and the Daughters of Bilitis. Those were the first lesbian rights groups and gay rights groups in the 1950s. They were confronting an extraordinary status quo of oppression. I think it's hard for people today to realize what things were like 50 or 60 years ago. So you couldn't get a job with the United States government if you were openly gay. You couldn't serve in the military. Local police and the FBI were likely to hound you. The postmaster would open your mail if they suspected that you might be receiving gay rights literature. Police routinely raided the gay bars where gays and lesbians would meet in order to exchange pleasantries with people who they identified like themselves. They didn't even have protection in their basic right to form an organization. You couldn't get lawyers to bring gay rights cases because they were afraid they'd be identified as gay, and the social price for that was just enormous. It's really quite extraordinary what the situation was like in the 1950s. Obviously, nobody then was dreaming of gay marriage.
How and when was all of what you just described first challenged then?
Well, there were these incipient social reform organizations in the 1950s, but you wouldn't identify it from today's perspective as a real gay rights movement. These organizations were still anonymous. You couldn't even identify yourself as a member of the Mattachine Society because you were afraid if you did, the postmaster would start tracking your mail and they would report you to your employer as being gay and they would alert your family members, and the price of that was just extraordinary. Even the American Civil Liberties Union in the 1950s didn't think there was any sort of constitutionally protected privacy right in same-sex relations between consenting adults. It's really only in the early 1970s that you get the formation of the sorts of gay rights organizations that we think of today as being real social reform organizations, the Human Rights Campaign, organizations like that. They didn't exist before the early 1970s. I think probably they arose partly because of the general social unrest in society. They patterned themselves after the civil rights movement, after the women's rights movement, after the anti-war movement. But there were also basic changes in society that were conducive to a movement for social reform with regard to gay rights, changing notions about sexuality, changing notions of privacy, changing gender norms. A lot of those things were conducive to challenging the social quo with regard to sexual orientation.
Is it your impression that the legal world was at all ahead of the rest of the world in terms of challenges being brought forth through the courts, or was it all sort of part and parcel of the same thing? As society was changing, so were legal interpretations. They go hand in hand.
That's a great question. My view in general is that courts are, for the most part, a reflection of society. They might move a little bit more quickly. They might move a little bit more slowly. It depends on the issue. But from a large perspective, from a broad point of view, courts never get that far out of touch with where society is. So, for example, the Supreme Court literally never protected women under the Equal Protection Clause until the women's rights movement had secured from Congress a constitutional amendment providing equality without regard to sex. The Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education was very explicit in the justices and their internal conversations about how much had changed with regard to race coming out of World War II. But it's also true that the justices are not a perfect reflection of society, and they do tend to come from a somewhat more elite segment. They're better educated. They're more affluent. They tend, by and large, to be somewhat less religiously devout. And that often translates into somewhat greater progressivism on issues like race or sex or sexual orientation. So I think you would probably find that there are court decisions in the 1960s and 1970s, not from the United States Supreme Court, but from lower federal courts and state Supreme Courts, that are slightly more progressive than the general social milieu, but not that much more progressive. So you don't have any courts in the 1960s or 1970s striking down the military's exclusion of gays or striking down limits on marriage to heterosexual couples. But you do have some decisions starting to protect the rights of students on campuses to organize gay rights clubs in the early 1970s. You do get some decisions starting to challenge the ability of governments to fire employees simply based on the fact that they're openly gay.
And then what about same-sex marriage itself? At what point do courts begin to play a role on that particular issue?
So there are same-sex couples who are trying to secure marriage licenses, and when they fail, turning to the courts as early as the early 1970s. So there are cases in the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Kentucky Court, the Washington State Court, in 1971 to 1973, demanding a right to same-sex marriage, and their cases are just casually dismissed. The judges are not even taking the claim very seriously in the early 1970s. Then you don't get a lot more of this until the early 1990s, and partly as a response to the AIDS epidemic, you start to see gay rights organizations focusing more on legal recognition of same-sex relationships. And then you get a lawsuit in Hawaii in 1990, 1991, and the national gay rights organizations don't even want anything to do with it, but a local ACLU lawyer is willing to bring the case. And that's really the beginnings of the modern wave of same-sex marriage litigation. So the case goes up to the Hawaii Supreme Court, and in 1993, the Hawaii court comes very close to recognizing a right to same-sex marriage. They kind of provisionally recognize such a right, but then they kick the case back for a trial on the merits, and the government gets a chance to defend the exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage if it can come up with a compelling justification for doing so. But most commentators expected when the case got back to the Hawaii Supreme Court, it would become the first in the world. Hawaii literally would have been the first jurisdiction in the world to have same-sex marriage. But before that could happen, the voters in Hawaii decided to amend their constitution to reject same-sex marriage. and about 35 states in Congress decided to pass statutes protecting traditional marriage from challenge.
Did this become a sort of common trend that there would be a court ruling or something approaching a likely ruling, and then the legislature would respond the other direction?
So I think that's exactly right, and that's probably the main theme of the book, is court decisions that advance far in front of public opinion on gay rights or any other issue often produce political backlash. So you see that pattern repeated several times, first in Hawaii, as I was just describing, leading to 35 states and Congress passing defense of marriage laws. Then the next decision is by the Vermont Supreme Court in 1999, and the Vermont Supreme Court stops short of marriage. It says you have to provide all the rights and benefits of marriage, but you don't have to call it that. And the Vermont legislature responds with civil unions in 2000, and that becomes the biggest political issue in Vermont politics that year. And a bunch of legislators, a couple dozen who had supported civil unions, lose their jobs in the November election. Then you get the Massachusetts Supreme Court in 2003, becoming the first in the country to squarely rule in favor of gay marriage. That leads to 25 states passing constitutional amendments barring gay marriage in the next 5 or 6 years. And it also turns the issue into a highly salient one all the way up to the presidential election in 2004, with President Bush really capitalizing on the issue and making John Kerry, his opponent, very uncomfortable, because Democrats in 2004 are not yet willing to come out in favor of gay marriage, but they're not also not willing to support a constitutional amendment at the federal level barring it. And then you had one more iteration of that pattern with the Iowa Supreme Court in 2009 ruling in favor of gay marriage, and three Iowa Supreme Court justices lost their jobs the next year when they were up for retention elections, and voters decided in a referendum, which was essentially turned into a one-issue referendum on gay marriage, they decided to fire the justices over their vote in favor of same-sex marriage.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the legal history of same-sex marriage in America with Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman, author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. The book examines same-sex marriage litigation and the political backlash it has produced. To join our conversation, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned there was this almost 20-year gap where there isn't any significant movement one way or the other on this issue from about 1971 until the early 90s. We have an email from Taylor who notes one of the figures that was prominent during this period and wanted to ask you about him, and that's Harvey Milk. He says, in San Francisco, Harvey Milk is often cited nearly as a Martin Luther King Jr. for gay rights. He asks, is this accurate, or is there another figure who might be equally important for the movement?
Harvey Milk was an important figure in the gay rights movement. I don't know that he had the same sort of dominant persona that Martin Luther King did. He was a famous figure in San Francisco politics. He was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, and then he was assassinated because of his sexual orientation late in the 1970s. He had become a very charismatic leader of the gay rights movement, but that was in Northern California. I think there are people all over the country who had probably never heard of Harvey Milk in a way that just wouldn't be true of Martin Luther King. But Harvey Milk also illustrates the hurdles that the gay rights movement had to overcome. He was elected as an openly gay man to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, but it took him two or three turns to do that. And in the 1970s, there were almost no openly gay or lesbian legislators in the United States. The very first in American history was elected to the Massachusetts legislature in 1974. By the late 1970s, there might have been a couple of openly gay state legislators interspersed throughout the country, but there was nobody in Congress until Barney Frank came out in the late 1970s as an openly gay congressional representative from Massachusetts. Same-sex sodomy, consenting sex between adults in private, was still a crime in a majority of states in the 1970s, which again illustrates how far off the radar screen something like same-sex marriage would have been. I think there are often a range of issues on topics like gay rights, and some of them are less controversial and some of them are more controversial. You can think of it as a kind of spectrum. And in the 1970s, the main objective of the gay rights movement was to get a repeal of these criminal prohibitions on same-sex sodomy and maybe to get some gay rights protections, getting sexual orientation added to a public accommodations law or an employment anti-discrimination law. Nobody was really thinking about same-sex marriage at that point in the movement's history.
On the other side of the political spectrum from Harvey Milk, in the period of the 70s and 80s, you had figures like Anita Bryant and Jerry Falwell. What impact did they have on this issue, whether we talk about specifically same-sex marriage or gay rights in general and some of the issues you just raised?
Right. So Anita Bryant is a figure from my childhood. I remember her quite well with the orange juice commercials, and she was a former beauty queen. And in 1977, she decided to lead a movement called Save Our Children in opposition to one of these gay rights ordinances I was mentioning. So the city of Miami and Dade County in Florida adopted one of the first in the country to adopt a gay rights ordinance in January of 1977. And Anita Bryant, who was a mother of several children, a devout Baptist, and a strong opponent of gay rights, she decided to mobilize a movement. She called it Save Our Children, the implication being that gays were child predators. And she organized enough opposition to the ordinance that in June, a few months after it was adopted, it was overwhelmingly defeated by about 70% to 30%. She then took her show on the road, and she went around the country opposing the ordinances that had been adopted in a handful of places like St. Paul, Minnesota, or Wichita, Kansas. She became a very prominent figure in the anti-gay rights movement. And this is sometimes treated as the beginnings of the religious right organizing politically. Jerry Falwell becomes a prominent figure in the religious right with the founding of the Moral Majority in 1979, and that becomes incredibly important because it gets really absorbed into the Republican Party. The Moral Majority plays a large role in organizing support for Ronald Reagan's candidacy for the presidency in 1980. And when he becomes president, the Moral Majority has a significant say within the Republican Party. And that's one of the most prominent and important developments in American politics in the last three decades, is the absorption within the Republican Party of a very fundamentalist religious movement, which is partly defined by opposition to abortion, but also partly defined by opposition to gay rights.
You mentioned earlier this sort of pattern of court rulings leading to legislative backlash. Was it that proponents of gay rights were seeking a redress through the courts solely, and that opponents were seeking a response solely through the legislature, or were both seeking solutions through both branches?
Right. It's a very good question. I don't think that the gay rights movement produced political backlash simply because they won in court. Their victories produced backlash because the substantive outcome of the policies that they were seeking and achieving was very controversial and was somewhat in advance of what public opinion was prepared to support. If they had won victories in legislatures, those also would have produced backlashes, and they did. So the example we were just discussing of Anita Bryant overturning the ordinance in Miami-Dade County, that's not an example of backlash against a judicial decision. That's backlash against a political decision. What happens after Anita Bryant's triumph in Miami-Dade is that local legislatures throughout the country become much more hesitant about embracing gay rights until they're convinced that public opinion will support them. So the reason why you get backlash is because their victories tend to come in court rather than simply because they're winning a court decision. So let me try to elaborate on that just a little bit. It's not the fact that a judge gave them the victory that generates the political resistance. It's simply the fact that they won a victory. And then it turns out they happen to be more likely to win in court than in a legislature, possibly because judges are somewhat, as we were discussing earlier, somewhat more progressive on these issues, perhaps because they're somewhat better educated, they've been to law school, perhaps because they're more affluent, perhaps because on average they're somewhat less religiously devout. they tend not to reflect the views of the average or median voter, but a somewhat more progressive view on issues of gay rights. And that might be why they get out in front, and that might be why you get the political backlash in response to court decisions. But it's nothing specific about court decisions. So another example of a political actor generating backlash would be Bill Clinton trying to repeal the ban on gays in the military in 1993 and generating enormous backlash, which ultimately forced him to back down.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Professor Michael Klarman, who teaches constitutional law and constitutional history at Harvard Law School. In 2005, he examined the Supreme Court and the struggle for racial equality in his book, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights. His latest book, From the Closet to the Altar, explores gay rights and specifically the legal battles over same-sex marriage. We welcome your questions and comments for Michael Klarman at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. Phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. All right, so you mentioned President Clinton seeking to address the ban on gays in the military, ultimately comes up with what he believes is a compromise or characterizes as a compromise, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which, of course, stands for a number of years. What other significant developments occur when it comes to the gay rights movement and specifically same-sex marriage in the early 1990s?
So in the early 1990s, you're beginning to get a focus on legal recognition for same-sex relationships. In Hawaii, that takes the form of litigation for same-sex marriage. Other places, they're trying to achieve something a little bit more, a little bit less aggressive, a little bit more mainstream, which is partnership benefits. So many people who have trouble with same-sex marriage also believe that a same-sex couple ought to enjoy the ability to go into hospital and seek visitation of their partner, or the ability to pass down property across the generations, or maybe even the ability to adopt children. That's one principal reform that the gay rights movement is seeking, some legal recognition of their relationships. But in the 1990s, they're also seeking hate crime legislation, so that if you target someone for a violent crime based on sexual orientation, that ought to be a factor aggravating the penalty in the same way that it is for a crime that targets a victim based on race. And they're seeking anti-discrimination laws. So the biggest issue, for example, in New York State in the 1990s is trying to add sexual orientation to the public accommodations law that already protects against discrimination in hotels and restaurants and theaters with regard to race or religion or sex. That was really the focal point, I think, at that time. And at the national level, the main focus of the gay rights movement was a federal law that would add to the anti-discrimination provision in the employment statute, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a ban on discrimination with regard to sexual orientation. That was really the main focus. That law still hasn't been accomplished. They have managed to secure hate crimes legislation at the federal level, and after 17 years of struggling, they finally managed to secure the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2010. But you still have that federal anti-discrimination law in employment. That's a principal goal of the gay rights movement at the national level.
What gave rise to the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, commonly known as DOMA?
This is very much a response to the Hawaii litigation. So with Hawaii being on the verge of becoming the first jurisdiction in the world to adopt same-sex marriage, a lot of other states start to get interested in the question, well, what if a pair of our citizens go to Hawaii and get married? Can they bring their marriage back to Utah or South Dakota, and we'll have to recognize it? And it turns out the constitutional law on that question is not entirely clear. And then this becomes a political issue. It becomes a very attractive issue for a certain group of politicians who can get voters riled up over the issue. And you know, those politicians tend to be Republicans, and this tends to be an issue that makes Democrats very uncomfortable, because at a time that 70% to 80% of the country oppose same-sex marriage, it would be a very risky proposition to oppose one of these Defense of Marriage Acts. Specifically, it becomes an issue at the federal level in conjunction with the 1996 presidential election. Bob Dole, who is the front runner for the Republican presidential nomination, becomes a sponsor of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Bill Clinton has to decide what his stance is going to be on this. He doesn't support gay marriage. He was very clear in the 1992 election. He was stopping short of gay marriage. But he also thinks this issue is being turned into a political football. He doesn't think we really need a federal statute forbidding same-sex marriage. And he thinks that this is really opportunists who are trying to take advantage of an issue. But he's running for president, and he realizes that 70 to 80% of the country opposes same-sex marriage. So to protect himself on the issue, he takes it off the agenda by saying if Congress passes the statute, he'll sign it. Congress passes it overwhelmingly. In the Senate, it's passed by something like 85 to 15. The only senator running for re-election in 1996 who opposes it is John Kerry. Every other senator, including Democrats who are running for re-election, support it. So it becomes law in 1996. Now, it doesn't look quite the same 16 years later, especially when you go back and look at the legislative history and you read some of the blatantly homophobic things that some sponsors of the legislation said. It doesn't look like a very attractive piece of legislation, but in 1996, the country was so different on same-sex marriage that it passed overwhelmingly.
DOMA has become, for some, a sort of litmus test, much like abortion, particularly for federal judicial nominees, Supreme Court nominees. They often face questions in confirmation hearings about it. What are the legal arguments for and against DOMA?
Right. So, you know, I think you're right that it was a litmus test at one point, but I think opinion may actually have changed enough on DOMA that now you're not going to find many nominees for the Supreme Court or for federal appointments in general who defend the statute. I think probably there are opinion polls today showing 60% or more of the country opposes DOMA. So the arguments against it are really twofold. There's both an individual rights argument and a federalism argument. The federalism argument is, regardless of whether you think same-sex marriage is constitutionally protected, there's no reason why Congress needs to have a federal mandate that defines marriage. So under this provision of DOMA, it doesn't matter whether you're married under state law. So Massachusetts has been marrying gay couples for 10 years. They're married in Massachusetts. But for federal purposes, whether you can get buried as the spouse of a veteran in a federally subsidized veteran cemetery, whether you can get Social Security survivor's benefits, whether you qualified as a married couple for purposes of filing a federal tax return, the federal government says we are not regarding you as married, regardless of what state law says. We are defining marriage as between a man and a woman. That is historically very unusual. The federal government usually defers to states on marriage, and one constitutional argument against the statute is Congress really has no reason why it should be defining marriage apart from state law. The other challenge is an individual rights argument, which would be the same argument applying to a state law forbidding gay couples access to marriage. And that argument is it denies the equal protection of the law to say to a couple, who you can get married depends on your sex. If you're a man under state or federal law that says marriage is between a man and a woman, who you can get married to depends on your sex and the sex of the objects of your affection, and that's either discrimination based on sex or it's discrimination based on sexual orientation. And unless the government can come up with a very strong justification for that, it violates the 14th Amendment. That's the other argument.
Do you see a day when DOMA may be overturned? And if so, on what of those two bases? Would it be on civil rights or on states' rights?
So it is being overturned. In the last 2 years, there have been a number of lower federal court decisions, district court in Boston, very recently a district court in New York, a court in California. And then just in the last year or so, two federal circuit courts, so the courts just below the Supreme Court, the one in New England and the one that covers New York and the Mid-Atlantic, they both struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And indeed, the Supreme Court is scheduled later this week on Friday to decide whether to grant review in those cases. So I think most experts are predicting the Supreme Court will grant review in one or a combination of those lower court Defense of Marriage Act cases, and the Supreme Court will then have the case on its docket and will likely decide it by the spring of 2013. It's always a little risky predicting Supreme Court decisions, but I would go out on a limb and say on this one, they're pretty likely to strike it down. And I would say they might even strike it down more than the usual 5-4 vote that characterizes most constitutional rulings these days. And I say that because of the combination of issues that are involved. I would think that the justices who are more politically liberal would sympathize with the claim for marriage equality. And I think the justices who are more conservative might not sympathize with that claim, but might sympathize with the federalism argument that Congress really has no business having its own definition of marriage rather than deferring as it traditionally has to the state definition. So I could imagine a vote on defense of marriage striking it down by more than the usual 5-4 that usually characterizes the court. And I think that's probably what's going to happen if they grant review, and most people think they will grant review.
We're talking about the legal history of same-sex marriage in America with Harvard Law professor Michael Klarman, author of From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. The book examines same-sex marriage litigation and the political backlash it has produced. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will take your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear revelations from well-known actors like Zach Galifianakis on the story behind his last name.
It's actually shortened, Terry. My real last name is Galifianakisberg. So, you know, that's an exclusive for your show.
Fresh Air, bringing you some of the biggest names in American culture and some of the most difficult to pronounce. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at cusaveenergy.com or 217-649-1173.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Professor Michael Klarman, who teaches constitutional law and history at Harvard Law School. In 2005, he examined the Supreme Court and the struggle for racial equality in his book, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights. His latest book, From the Closet to the Altar, explores gay rights, and specifically the legal and political battles over same-sex marriage. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll go first to Mike in Champaign. Hi, Mike.
Hello, good morning. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the history of the institution of marriage and who invented it, who owns it, and how did the organized government get and the church get tied together in this way, and also related question is, you know, is there a semantics issue here? I think maybe some people feel like the idea of marriage or the institution belongs to the church, and those who are proposing these types of civil and legal rights and so forth are trying to force the church to adopt a definition of marriage that they don't want to have anything to do with, for the most part. I mean, that may not be entirely true, but so say a little bit about the history and how we got tied together, and maybe the church could invent a new institution which they were more happy with, or the state could, foster this conflict. I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks very much. Good questions, Mike. We appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. So the institution of marriage has changed a lot. The opponents of same-sex marriage are mostly emphasizing what they call traditional marriage, but the supporters of same-sex marriage are quick to point out that the meaning of marriage and the legal regulation of marriage have changed a lot over the years. So if you look back for example, to the Bible, you find polygamy is frequently practiced, the idea that you can marry more than one person. Historically in the United States, at one point, most states in the Union forbade interracial marriage. As late as the 1950s, half the states still forbade interracial marriage. In the 19th century, marriage was still an institution where women, once they became married, basically lost their independent status as legal entities. Married women could not contract, they could not own property, they could not sue in court. They were essentially the property of their husbands. So the meaning of marriage has changed a lot, and its social significance. I mean, people used to get married for economic reasons. You'd have arranged marriages, you'd have efforts to combine families in different ways, you had people getting married and reproducing children because they needed help, they needed basically free labor on the farm, whereas in the 20th, 21st century, people get married because they fall in love and they don't necessarily are interested in procreating, not necessarily interested in having children. They get married because of love and affection and companionship. It's partly that change in the understanding of marriage that has produced more support for same-sex marriage. As marriage became less about procreation, as it became less about reproducing large numbers of children, as it became more about simply choosing a partner, somebody who you were in love with, the argument became, well, why should that be limited to opposite-sex couples? And one of the factors, I think, one of the important factors in influencing the push for same-sex marriage in the last 30 or 40 years has been this changing understanding of marriage. And indeed, you know, marriage as an institution was something that the gay rights movement was not sure it wanted in the way that institution was traditionally defined. So, you know, many feminists in the 1970s were not very keen on marriage because traditionally women within marriage had been oppressed. It was seen as a misogynistic institution, and many lesbians were not really that interested in that sort of institution, and the debate within the gay marriage movement was whether we can transform the meaning of marriage by expanding it to same-sex couples. The other part of what Mike was saying is the idea of the affiliation with the church. Many people have talked about deregulating marriage. Most of the opposition to marriage equality is religiously inspired, and nobody is saying that the church has to recognize these marriages, but if the state is the one that's deciding who can get married, the state's not supposed to do things for religious reasons. So one way you could solve this problem is to deregulate marriage. Say the government simply is going to grant approval to any pair of consenting adults who want to get married, and then churches can decide for themselves if they want to sanctify that marriage in church, but that won't have any legal significance. Legal significance comes from the state, and the state's not allowed to act for religious reasons, and therefore the state can't be opposing marriage equality simply because people who are religiously inspired oppose it.
One of the arguments that you do hear in opposition to same-sex marriage is that marriage itself is, by definition, a religious institution, at least in the eyes of some. What is the legal response to that?
Right. So, you know, we have a body of well-established law under the Establishment Clause, and that body of law says it's not good enough for government to defend a policy on the ground that it serves a religious purpose. So, you know, we don't have established churches, and we don't provide support for religious institutions, and we don't provide support for religious practices. That doesn't mean that religious people don't get to have a say in secular issues. Obviously, if the nation's deciding whether to go to war, people who oppose war, who are pacifists because they're Quakers, they're still entitled to participate in the debate. And if we're deciding how to regulate abortion within the bounds of constitutional law, if we're deciding how to regulate abortion, Catholics get to have a position on that, even if that position turns out it was religiously inspired. What you don't get to do, however, is simply defend a policy or statute on the grounds of religion. You have to come up with a facially secular justification, which is why in same-sex marriage cases, government always has to put forth an argument other than the Bible says marriage should be between a man and a woman. That may be good enough for a voter in a referendum on same-sex marriage, but it's not good enough for a lawyer who's defending a statute in court that excludes gay people from marriage. That's why government has to come up with arguments such as children do better when raised by a man and a woman, or the government wants to link together marriage with procreation, or some other sort of secular argument That's just the way Establishment Clause doctrine works in the United States. It's simply not good enough to defend a law based on a religious view. You have to come up with some other facially secular justification.
Lewis is in Chicago and wants to talk a little bit more about the definition of marriage. Lewis, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I don't agree with the idea of redefining marriage. I think it should be between a husband and a wife, but I just wanted to challenge the assertion that it's becoming the majority opinion that that this should be allowed. I think the vast majority of states have voted against it, and if you look at the changing demographics, the groups coming into the country now are strongly opposed to that type of thing, especially Hispanics and other immigrant groups, and even among blacks. I think the only states which passed it are very liberal states.
Okay, thanks for the call and the comment. And I guess I would reiterate, and I'd like your comment on this, Michael Klarman. Public opinion polls, at least in the last few years, have pretty much repeatedly sort of indicated a majority of Americans do now support same-sex marriage. But that is a very recent phenomenon.
It is, and Lewis makes a good point, and I'm glad to have the chance to elaborate. So two different things that he said. First is he doesn't support the idea of redefining marriage. And I would simply say in response to that, we've always defined and redefined marriage. So as I was pointing out a moment ago, in the 1950s, about 25 states forbade interracial marriage, and I don't think anybody today would support that. We redefined marriage. The opponents of interracial marriage said, don't redefine it. We did redefine it because we all reject today white supremacy, and that's a good thing. In the 19th century, women who got married were essentially the property of their husbands. Nobody defends that anymore. Nobody defends the idea that a woman who's married shouldn't be able to own property or sue in her own name or have custody of her children upon divorce. We redefined marriage. That was a drastic redefinition of marriage, but we all agree with it. So we always redefine marriage. I don't think it's a sufficient argument against doing so today that we shouldn't redefine it. We have to have a debate on the merits about whether it should be redefined in this particular way, but simply saying we should leave it the way it's traditionally done, we don't do that. We've repudiated many past definitions of marriage. Now, on the other point, which is a good point, voters in most states have rejected same-sex marriage. That's true, but that's a function of when they voted on it. It's also true that the opponents of gay marriage, the way they have tried to normalize what happened on November 6th, the way they've tried to deal with it is to say, well, it's only in the bluest states. But in fact, this change is underway everywhere. So if you look, there are pretty sophisticated statistical models on when states are likely to have a majority in favor of same-sex marriage. And it's true, today it's the bluer states, but that's not to say that opinion's not changing in the other states. So I'll give you an illustration of that. North Carolina voted against same-sex marriage by 22 percentage points in May. Now, the opponents of gay marriage treated that as a big victory. In North Carolina, they rejected it by 61% to 39%. That, however, itself is a dramatic change from what would have happened 5 or 6 or 8 years earlier. 6 years before, in 2006, North Carolina's neighbors, Tennessee and South Carolina, had a vote on same-sex marriage, and they rejected it by 50 or 60 percentage points as compared to the 22 points in North Carolina. So opinions changing even in the South, which is the reddest part of the country, even in the most religious part of the country, it's changing. It's changing at the rate of a couple percentage points a year. And according to one of these sophisticated statistical models, within 12 years from today, every state in the country will have a majority in favor of same-sex marriage. That includes Mississippi, which had a vote on same-sex marriage in 2004 and rejected it by 86 to 14%. Even in Mississippi, at the rate at which opinion is changing, there will be a majority of people in favor of same-sex marriage by 2024. And it's true that even among Hispanics, even among African Americans, groups that have perhaps been a little bit more resistant to gay marriage than the average American, probably because of religiosity, even among those groups, there's much greater support. So in Maryland, they voted in favor of gay marriage, even though African Americans are 30% of the Maryland population, and exit polls showed that African American support for gay marriage were up dramatically over what it had been in the preceding years. So, you know, it's true, there have only been three states so far, but that's because most of the referenda were conducted years ago and opinions changing so dramatically. You're going to see in the next year or two, there are going to be a bunch more of these referenda and a bunch more state legislatures. And they're clear majorities in states like California, Oregon, Rhode Island, clear majorities in favor. And Illinois is close. Illinois will be one of those states where there will be legislation within the next year or two.
And there is, in fact, talk that lawmakers might consider a bill legalizing same-sex marriage during their veto session, which begins today in Springfield. Would it surprise you if such a vote were to take place this week here in Illinois?
No, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the question is, you don't want to fight on this too early and lose and then not be able to come back for a couple of years. So I would think there'll be a decision whether this is something that you have a majority in favor of. And if they think they've got it, they'll go for it. If not, they'll wait for a couple of years. So, you know, California, they got gay marriage from a court decision in 2008, and it was just a little bit too soon, and it was rejected in a referendum by 5 points. And in California, they've not revisited the issue yet, although there are courts that have struck down Proposition 8. If California had another referendum today, they would clearly adopt it. And they make this calculation in each state. Do we have a majority? If we're forced to defend it at the polls, can we do it? And they calculate it in Washington State, and they calculate it in Maryland, and they calculate it in Maine. We think we have support now, even though we didn't just a few years ago. And in each state, they calculated right. And I think, you know, most surprisingly on November 6th was Minnesota, where there was an effort to pass a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage, and the amendment was defeated. That's only the second time voters have ever defeated a proposed amendment to ban gay marriage. And Illinois is a bluer state than Minnesota, right? Obama won Minnesota by 5 to 10 points, and he won Illinois, I think, by closer to 20 points. So Illinois is a bluer state than Minnesota. I would think the vote in Minnesota has got to inspire gay rights activists in Illinois to think the time may be ripe to go for it. If not now, certainly within the next year or two.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to try and get in at least one more call, maybe two. I'll ask our callers and our guests to be brief in questions and responses. Let's go next to Daryl in Bloomington. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. Illinois has a civil union law on their website. They explain the parameters that civil union has the same parameters as traditional marriage, and it lists as an example like close relatives cannot have civil unions. But in traditional marriage, there's a basis for not having close relatives marry, but there's no basis for close relatives not marrying in same-sex marriages. Why couldn't sisters marry each other? Why couldn't cousins marry each other? It seems that by pushing same-sex rights into marriage, you're not so much expanding rights as you're actually innovating a new social institution. And on what basis would you deny other groups that want to make innovations in that institution?
Okay. Thanks very much for the question.
Well, it's a very interesting question. Government can define civil unions any way that it wants. If we believe either for social reasons or for biological reasons, it's harmful to have first cousins marrying. And I believe the jury's actually out on that. There's been some evidence in recent years that maybe biologically there isn't that strong a basis against it. But if you think that there is, or if you think society doesn't sanction it, then society simply defines civil unions not to include close relatives. In the same way that we define marriage not to allow polygamy. You know, what's the basis for that? That's going to be an issue in the next 30 years. People are going to say, why is it that we're not allowing consenting adults to choose the sorts of relationships they want? And if three people want to get married, what's the government's argument against that? I think government's going to need to do better than just come up with a religious argument, but there are arguments. I mean, polygamy, as traditionally practiced, is oppressive to women, and as traditionally practiced, it's mostly an excuse for child abuse. If you could imagine a system where polygamy had neither of those features, then I think there would be a serious question whether the government has a good enough justification for suppressing it. And I think that will be an issue in the next few decades.
We have just a minute left. I want to go to Rick in Crawford County. Rick, go ahead.
Yes, I would like to question the basis that religion is a great part of marriage rights. I am a genealogist, and I have studied my county's court records and find that despite the fact there are a great number of denominational churches scattered across the county, most of the weddings were performed by judges and justices of the peace. therefore making it a civil ceremony rather than a religious one.
All right, Michael Klarman.
So marriage obviously has both civil and religious components. It is the case that most of the opposition to marriage equality is grounded in religiosity, and there's some stunning exit polls from Proposition 8 in California. So of the people who go to church once a week or more, those are the people we usually define as the most religiously inspired, 85% of those people supported banning same-sex marriage in the state constitution. Among the group of people who report that they rarely or never go to church, 85% supported expanding marriage to same-sex couples. So that's just a stunning correlation between religiosity and views about same-sex marriage, which would suggest that a lot of the opposition to marriage equality is rooted in religion. And as I was saying a few minutes ago, if you're defending a law in court, it's not good enough to say, well, this is the way the Bible does it. You need some other secular justification to defend the statute.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Michael Klarman teaches constitutional law and constitutional history at Harvard Law School. His newest book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts Backlash and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael Klarman, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Craig. I enjoyed it.
We welcome any additional thoughts you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. You can hear this program twice each weekday, live at 10 a.m. Central Time, then repeated weeknights at 8 on WILL AM 580. On tomorrow's show, we'll welcome your car care questions for Rick Karch, auto mechanic from Rick's Automotive in Champaign. If you're having problems with your car, just call in with the make and model and description of the problem. Rick will suggest a solution. That's on Wednesday's Focus. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.